I want to talk about not only about Vanderbilt, but also my approach to writing a biography. You know, people naturally wonder, well, how do you win a Pulitzer Prize? And, you know, my answer is, looks like weight, I think, mostly. But, I mean, the answer is, of course, there is no answer. So let me just describe my approach, which I've been very fortunate. I don't kid myself that I'm not lucky in being honored as I have been. But my approach to writing a biography, and I often describe it as trying to tell good stories and also to ask big questions. I try to find individuals whose lives are dramatic and colorful and always entertaining for me as a writer as well as a reader. And then I also try to find someone who's significant, whose impact on the world is very visible, and also through whom we can get a better understanding of the past. Using that person, the context, the historical context, is not only a way of understanding that person in their inner life, which is very important to me, who they are as an individual, but also using that person as a way of better understanding the context and asking fresh questions about the world, the creation of the world that we're in today. Well, Cornelius Vanderbilt presented himself. This is a fellow who was born during the presidency of George Washington and lived long enough to make deals personally with John D. Rockefeller. His life spans the transformation of the United States from a coastal strip of former colonies to a continent-wide industrial titan with railroad lines and factories and telegraph lines and financial markets and giant corporations. The modern United States came into being during his lifetime, and he was right there at the center all the way. This is somebody who gave a carriage ride to Lafayette, someone who hired Daniel Webster as an attorney and sat in Chief Justice John Marshall's courtroom. This is someone who gave a ferry ride to Andrew Jackson and was in a train wreck in a two-car train alongside John Quincy Adams. Somebody who negotiated with Lord Palmerston in Britain and did business with P.T. Barnum, who advised President Lincoln on how to fight the Merrimack or the Virginia, for you Confederates in the audience. Someone who bailed Jefferson Davis then out of prison. Someone who, of course, endowed Vanderbilt University. This is someone whose life was wrapped up in the entire, almost the entire 19th century, three quarters of it. And yet there had not been a serious biography of him since 1942, when a business biography, pretty good one for the sources available at the time, a business biography came out, interestingly, from the same publisher as I have. Well, that's a long time. 1942 to now is a long time. And I soon found out why. No one hated himself enough to undertake the task. There's no collection of Vanderbilt papers. This is a man who, his longtime clerk gave an interview after Vanderbilt's death, and he said he abominated papers. That after he read a letter, he would pitch it into the fire. And I read one letter written to, not many letters survive in his own hand. You know, they're scattered around in other archival collections. One letter he wrote to the father of his daughter-in-law, and he said, yours is the only family, he's very fond of them. He said, yours is the only family I ever write to. I much dislike to write, and I never do so outside of business matters. So they're, you know, historians are kind of like, I like the old joke about the drunk who drives home and he gets out of the car in the driveway and he drops his keys and his wife finds him on his hands and knees on the porch looking for his keys. And she asks and he explains. She says, why aren't you in the driveway? He says, well, the light's better here. So it doesn't matter how important someone is. Historians often like to write about people who have a nice collection of papers. So if you go to the kind of dusty, unread scholarly biographies, you'll find biographies of people you've never heard of, and yet they're important people like Vanderbilt who just are too daunting a task to undertake. And so the reason the story took so long, though, almost seven years, is that rather than finding nothing, I thought, you know, okay, there isn't much. That means I can wrap it up in a couple of years. No, I kept finding one thing after another, and I kept finding more and more information, whole episodes of his life that no one had ever known about. A whole world of business. In the 19th century, when there was a lot of business deals were verbal, when a lot of stuff was not written down, a whole business culture and deals and attitudes toward new things like competition and nationwide businesses, which were new, and all these other things. This whole world came to life in the research that I was doing. And so it took more and more time until finally, when I was wrapping up, I was terrified that I would find something else and add another year to the process. So let me now, you know, having described my foolishness in taking on this project, let me just describe Vanderbilt's life for those of you who are unfamiliar. This is someone whose life falls pretty neatly into three distinct categories: his years in steamboats, his years in ocean-going steamships, and then finally the last phase of his life when he was the great railroad tycoon, the foremost figure of the railroad titans of the late 19th century. Well, this is a fellow who was born to parents who were farmers, not wealthy at all, very striving, sort of up by the bootstraps people, on Staten Island. Now it's a borough of Manhattan, or of New York, excuse me. Then it was a rural island across the New York Harbor from New York City, which was a city of 33,000 people, occupying just the southern end of Manhattan Island. But New York was obviously becoming sort of the great financial and commercial center of America, even at that 1790s, even at that early stage. And so the accident, he was born to a rural family, like most Americans, but the accident of being within sight, literally within sight, of what was becoming the most important business center in America was one of those accidents that allowed his innate talents and his family orientation to blossom into one of the great business careers in world history. And his father owned a sailboat. Well, you know, a natural thing if you live in an island without bridges, but he was very actively involved in the kind of small trade of the boatmen in New York Harbor, and Vanderbilt learned this trade. His mother also was very active in business. I don't know how she built her sort of nest egg, her sort of original capital. You know, she might have been raising vegetables and selling them or doing sewing. But as she saved her whatever money she was earning, and she lent it out. And I found a court record that shows, and she was tough, I found a court record that showed she foreclosed a mortgage she had extended to her own daughter after her daughter was widowed. So, you know, clearly you can't afford to pay me anymore, so that farm is mine. And this is someone who Vanderbilt revered. And I have the suspicion, I don't mention this in the book, I suspect that all through his life he was trying to please his mother and show her that he was as tough and smart and frugal as she was all of his life. So he got this education in the marketplace early on. And when he was just 16, he began to sail his own boat, and he started running a ferry across New York Harbor to Staten Island. And it was a boat that was technically owned by his parents, but he got part of the proceeds, and he began to build his own boat with that money. Then he began to set himself up as a small merchant. Well, you know, in the early, you know, again, 18th century America, that's all the wealthy men in the country were just sort of general merchants. They did a little bit of everything. They bought and sold cargoes, they owned the ships, they had their own distribution network, the merchant, the general merchant, and that's what he was becoming. Then an accident happened that changed his life and changed American history. This fellow named Thomas Gibbons, who was a planter from Georgia, who had settled in New Jersey because he couldn't get along with his wife anymore. In fact, he could barely get along with anyone. He had had a falling out with a neighbor and business partner named Aaron Ogden, and Ogden refused to fight a duel with Thomas Gibbons. Gibbons had fought at least three duels in his lifetime. He decided he would bankrupt this fellow instead. Well, Aaron Ogden had a steamboat that was running as a ferry across from New Jersey to New York, and so Gibbons got in the steamboat business. And his captain just disappeared, and so he hired this young boatman, Cornelius Vanderbilt, to be his captain. Well, they thought it would be a few days. He ended up working for Gibbons until he died 8 years later, and then for his son for a couple of years. And this business battle was important between Vanderbilt and Ogden, because not only was business competition pretty new in America, but also because it was a legal battle. Ogden had a license for his steamboat from the Livingston family, an old patrician family in New York that had a monopoly on steamboats. And they had the right under New York state law to seize boats coming into New York waters from other states. that they could erect a barrier on interstate trade that went by steam. And so in order to bankrupt this personal enemy Gibbons had a spite against, he had to go to the Supreme Court and get the Supreme Court to declare that this was a violation of the Commerce Clause. Interestingly, there was so little interstate trade, this ended up being the first decision the Supreme Court ever issued on the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. So it was not settled law. In fact, the monopoly had been held up by judge after judge, and it was considered to be perfectly legal. So Vanderbilt got involved in this. This is an uneducated man, guy who had gone to work very early on. He could write, in the Gibbons papers, there are a lot of his letters in his own hand. He could write the same three-letter word three different ways in the same letter. So Vanderbilt was not educated. He wrote phonetically. But he was not only smart, he focused upon what he needed to know. So he learned this new technology of steam. He made himself a student of the great early steam engine manufacturers in New York. And Vanderbilt eventually ended up being one of the great architects of the paddle wheel era, designing steamboats and steamships, ocean-going steamships driven by steam and by paddle wheels. And his ships were the fastest, most fuel-efficient, and strongest, and he designed them personally, a man with no education. When it came to the law, when it came to running a business, this new enterprise he was managing for Thomas Gibbons, he was learning about how to deal with things he never dealt with before, underlings and buying supplies and dealing with a harbor master and all this, the complexity of a large business for the time. And then finally, there was the law. Again, this uneducated man became the legal representative for Thomas Gibbons, who himself was a highly skilled lawyer and politician. And so he was going out and representing Gibbons with lawyers. He went off himself to hire Daniel Webster to represent the case before the Supreme Court. He stuck around to hear an early hearing because he really wanted to know about the details of a legal struggle. So Vanderbilt, this accident, and then, of course, the case ended in a victory for it was Gibbons v. Ogden established that states cannot interfere with interstate commerce, the first decision, 1824, that settled that. So it changed the American legal and commercial landscape, opened the way for the economic future of the United States. But it also was this amazing transformation of this farm boy who was running an open sailboat on New York Harbor, who then learned about, you know, technology, he learned about business operations, he learned about the law, and he made connections with influential and wealthy people. It opened up his horizons. And as I put it in the book, it lifted him from the water level of running a boat to these larger horizons of large business. And when, after Gibbons died, and Vanderbilt was one of the few people who could get along with him. Vanderbilt really, he was like a second father to Vanderbilt. He was a real mentor, this tough old Southern planter who wanted to fight a duel with anybody who looked at him crosswise. Then, after Gibbons died, he went off on his own, and he started a series of steamboat lines that extended out of New York to wherever, and this marks his whole career, wherever the vital center of American commerce went, that's where Vanderbilt went. And you can actually trace the changing American economy by following Vanderbilt's operations. So in these steamboat years, he ran first, you know, to Philadelphia, when New York to Philadelphia was important. When the Erie Canal opened, Vanderbilt started to run his steamboats up to where the Erie Canal emptied out into the Hudson River. Then when the Industrial Revolution took off in New England and factories opened up in New England, Vanderbilt began to get involved in the route between New England and New York. And he also became one of the preeminent competitors. You know, this is an age when people argued about the idea of competition itself. And Vanderbilt very publicly made himself into a sort of a symbol of competitiveness, of this new culture that was replacing the old colonial culture dominated by old landed families, you know, with a kind of hierarchical sense of society. Vanderbilt very consciously represented a new individualistic, you can lift yourself up, every man can get ahead by his merits, culture in America. And business and politics and culture was all wrapped up together. And you very much see the changes in America, broad changes in Vanderbilt's life. And it also, interestingly, brought him into the early corporation and the early railroads. The first railroads, there wasn't a lot of money for railroads, and Vanderbilt got involved with them because they connected to his steamboats in New England. And he eventually went on the boards of directors. And in 1847, almost two decades before most historians thought he was involved in railroads, I found that he actually became president of a railroad line. So again, he saw that railroads were a new technology. He saw that the corporation was this new form of business organization that he had to master, and he mastered it. He went into it with, jumped in with both feet, and was getting involved again in these regional lines between New York and New England. But then something happened. I want to leave time for questions. Then something happened that changed his life and changed American history, the California Gold Rush. And Vanderbilt abruptly abandoned all of these regional steamboat lines, and he got involved in the steamship traffic to California. And, you know, we think of the California Gold Rush being about the wagon trains that cross the Rocky Mountains. Well, you know, about half the people and almost all of the commerce went by steamship down to Panama, where there was a land crossing and later a railroad, and then another steamship line that ran up to New York. And this was a federally subsidized line. Congress began to subsidize it before the gold was discovered. And then, of course, the way that lobbying works, and lobbying took off in this era. Some of the tales are amazing of the lobbyists, like literally bribing congressmen. Because of this great flowering of lobbying, even though these subsidized steamship lines began to make money hand over fist with the California Gold Rush, they still kept collecting these huge subsidies. Vanderbilt, regardless of that, got involved in the business and competed against these subsidized lines. And he tried to build a canal across Nicaragua, which was farther north, and had natural waterways almost all the way across. That fell through. Vanderbilt started a transit company that carried passengers across. And this made him, it transformed him from a regional figure to a national, even international figure. He became Commodore Vanderbilt when Commodore was the highest rank in the U.S. Navy. This became such a common expression that presidents referred to him as Commodore. I found letters from his second wife that have survived in which she not only called him Commodore, her nickname for him was Com. So, you know, this is, he, and it was an unofficial title, and yet he was the Commodore. If you said, you know, referred to the Commodore in 1851, everybody knew who you meant. And so this again, it made him not only an international figure. When his business rivals got involved with an American adventurer who invaded Nicaragua and took away Vanderbilt's rights to carry passengers across, and this fellow William Walker gave those rights to Vanderbilt's enemies, Vanderbilt actually negotiated with the neighboring countries, especially Costa Rica, who were going to war with this American invader. And Vanderbilt sent down a secret agent with crates of gold, and the secret agent actually led a commando raid that was instrumental in driving this American. Vanderbilt actually went to war to defeat his rivals and to drive this American filibuster, William Walker, out of the country. So the epic stories that are taking place. And this period ended right before the Civil War with Vanderbilt establishing a shared monopoly on the steamship lines to California. And what happened during the Civil War? Well, again, after some very interesting involvement in the Union war effort, which I alluded to earlier, he abruptly went out of steamships at the age of 70 and went into railroads with both feet. At an age when he was well past life expectancy, he decided that he was going to make this abrupt change, the second or perhaps third huge change in his life. And he started off with a line, the New York and Harlem, that ran down the center of Manhattan. And he'd been involved in the management over the years. He'd actually, again, in the early railroad industry, Vanderbilt was one of the first great corporate architects, the great masters of corporate finance. Vanderbilt stepped in, and he'd reformed its finances. And then once he'd helped clean it up as sort of a member of the board of directors, then he began to buy stock, began to own it. And Wall Street thought this was a joke, that it was a worthless company. Vanderbilt saw advantages no one else did. And it was sort of a late-life hobby. He said, you know, I can prove that this business is worth something. And what happened is, due to the fragmented nature of the railroad network, all these little lines that made up the map of railroads in America had been built for local purposes, and they ended up linking up. So, you know, one line to ship your stuff from, you know, Kentucky to New York or to Philadelphia, for example, for export, agricultural goods, whatnot, you had to ship them across multiple lines, which made it expensive and slow and inefficient. And these lines fought with each other. Vanderbilt actually, surprisingly, I found he didn't want to take over a huge railroad empire at the outset. He actually was a diplomat. He wanted to run his line, show that he could be successful. as he put it, if he couldn't run a railroad for $2 million less than the last guys who were running it, he would close business and go out and just quit, you know, quit his career. Well, if he was running a steamship, he said, if I couldn't run it for 20% less than someone running a steamship alongside of me, I would have quit and gone out of the business. Again, one of the great distinctions of great entrepreneurs, their mastery of costs. And his also, he paid attention to infrastructure and improving the line as well. He just wanted to run his line and show that he could make a profit with it. But he fell into conflicts. Now, these conflicts led to him taking over one line after another and constructing one of the, you know, he would fight. He didn't want the fight, but he would fight. He would win. He'd take over that line. And he ended up constructing this massive railroad system between New York and Chicago. And such was his mastery of corporate finance and interstate business that everybody assumed he'd planned it from the beginning because it was so smoothly carried out. And this led to great, again, one of the great transformations in the American economy, this low-cost, high-efficiency, interregional railroad network. It integrated different regions of the country. It drastically lowered rates by which people traveled or sent goods. It created great wealth. During the Panic of 1873, half the railroads in the country went bankrupt in the depression that followed. Almost all railroads stopped paying dividends, which is what was expected of stocks at the time, that you would pay a healthy dividend. Vanderbilt's lines, his core line, the New York and Hudson River Railroad, made dividends automatic. The board stopped voting on them. They just issued their dividends every quarter because it was such a well-run line, so efficiently managed. And this is all due to the vision of Vanderbilt and his son who came in, William Henry, as his manager, their capabilities. But my book is not either a screed against the evil robber barons, nor is it preaching about the glories of unfettered capitalism. Rather, I tried to identify the arguments that Americans had at the time about Vanderbilt. You know, those early years when competition itself was seen as bad, how they fought about him. And then later, in his when he was no longer an upstart, but he was the great railroad tycoon, how they argued about him. And this argument we see, and this is why I would like to wrap up. Actually, I'll say something about his family before I wrap up. But this is one of the great issues that we still see today. We still have this argument. For example, in 1867, I'll take two examples, two key episodes in which he built his empire. Vanderbilt, in 1866, controlled the lines that ran from New York to Albany, where they connected with one of the great trans-Appalachian railroads, the trunk lines, the New York Central Railroad, which he did not yet control. Well, in late 1866, a fellow named Henry Keep, who despised Vanderbilt, they hated each other, came in and took over the New York Central and immediately put a stop to a hard-won agreement between the Central and Vanderbilt's lines. So they wouldn't negotiate. They just wouldn't talk to Vanderbilt. They felt they had the upper hand. So Vanderbilt said, fine. He issued an edict saying, my railroads will no longer accept trains from the New York Central Railroad. Well, you know, during the summer, this didn't matter much because the New York Central would transfer a lot of its passengers and freight to steamboats that would run down the Hudson River. They could still connect to New York City. But this was deep winter. The Hudson River was frozen. Not only that, but there were no bridges across the Hudson River to New York City. And the winter blizzard had cut off all ferry traffic across New York Harbor. With one blow, this one railroad tycoon, in order to settle a private business dispute, essentially erected a blockade around the nation's largest city, cutting it off from contact with the rest of the country. Now, this naturally sparked exactly the kind of argument that people are having now about, well, you know, our banks, if they're too big to fail, you know, maybe we should have the government regulating them, breaking them up. You know, this is an argument that no matter how you fall on that argument, we see that argument starting around Vanderbilt. Here's a private party pursuing its private interests, and yet its acts affect the public interest in a big way. Now, lucky for the public, the New York Central men, Henry Keep, they bought their stock on margin. They needed a high stock price to keep those stocks. The stock price collapsed with the blockade, and they had to sell out. Vanderbilt won. He ended up taking control of the railroad. The blockade ended after a few days. The New York State Legislature launched an investigation, and they asked Vanderbilt. You know, they were contemplating a law that would give the state the power to settle these disputes so there would be no disruption of the railroad network. And Vanderbilt said, well, that's all well and good if you can pass a law that gets men to pursue their interests more effectively, that's fine, but I don't think you can. That strange answer essentially says, I don't recognize the existence of a public interest that's separate from private interests. This uneducated man was a pure Adam Smith thinker. He believed the public interest was everyone pursuing their private interests as effectively as possible, as aggressively as possible. Very interesting. Then a second episode happened. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, you know, in addition to inconveniencing people terribly with some of his fights, he also created wealth. And so, you know, I'm not beating up on him. I'm not praising him. I'm trying to present him honestly in the way people argued about him. In 1869, the second example is, now that he had the New York Central and he made it into this giant corporation, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, he connected to Chicago, the great metropolis of the Midwest, through a new railroad called the Lakeshore. And he was struggling for control. He didn't have all of the stock. He had a chunk, but not all of it. He was struggling with a man named LeGrand Lockwood, who happened to have been an old ally of the defeated Henry Keep. And LeGrand Lockwood was fighting with Vanderbilt and had sort of had the upper hand in the railroad's management. And he was making an alliance with Jay Gould, Vanderbilt's famous enemy, about whom I could spend 6 hours talking. So Vanderbilt said, fine. He bided his time. He waited until the fall when all of that money was flowing out of New York to the countryside. The credit market in New York, the money market, grew tight. Stock prices tended to falter because people couldn't get credit to buy stock on margin. LeGrand Lockwood, Vanderbilt knew, had bought massive amounts of Lakeshore stock on margin. He also knew that his ally, Jay Gould, was tightening up the credit market by trying to corner the gold market. So he waited and he waited, and then at the moment when the money market was at its tightest, he dumped all of his Lakeshore stock all at once. And it contributed to a panic called Black Friday, in which the stock market collapsed. LeGrand Lockwood could no longer carry his stock. His brokers had to sell it all out. He went bankrupt. Vanderbilt then went outside of the U.S. economy to Baring Brothers of London, took a huge loan, bought back his own stock and LeGrand Lockwood's at reduced prices. With one blow, he bankrupted an enemy, he got control of a major railroad, and he profited hugely in the stock market through short selling. However, he also helped to cause a panic to do so. He knowingly damaged the entire financial market on Wall Street in order to carry out this private operation. Now, interestingly, this is what Goldman Sachs and a hedge fund called Magnetar have been accused of. Now, you know, I don't know the facts, so I want to stress that this is an accusation that's been levied at them, that they created securities that were designed to fail, merger-backed securities, so that they could sell them but bet against them, that they were deliberately wanted the market to collapse because they were betting against it, and they were helping it to collapse. So what they're accused of is exactly what Vanderbilt did. But here's the difference. Vanderbilt, of course, needed stock prices to be high, and the stock market was so small. You know, now we've got a huge economy, a huge financial sector. At the time, railroads were almost the only shares that were traded actively on Wall Street. And Vanderbilt was so wealthy compared to the market that he was able to then go to Wall Street, which he never did, went in person to the stock exchange, and began giving orders to buy stocks in his own railroads. You know, he didn't own all the stock. He owned a lot of it, so he started to buy more. And the brokers were literally cheering him on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Vanderbilt helped cause a panic, and then he single-handedly stopped it. And so, you know, for the country, they're very lucky that he was good at this. But again, it raised questions, and it spurred on a debate about maybe the government should be regulating this stuff. And it took decades for this debate to play out and lead to actual federal regulation, because it was hard fought. There were a lot of people on the other side saying, for all the ups and downs, no, the government should stay out. And again, you know, my point is not to say, you know, this is what's wrong, this is what's right. It's to say, this is the debate, and this is where we see it forming. And Vanderbilt is a really interesting way to look at this. I mean, he had an amazing life. The last thing I'll say is just about his family. You know, again, I've been talking about his public career, but he also had this very complex family life. He had 13 children, 11 of whom survived to adulthood, and he had three sons, And he, the sons were a disappointment to him for a long time. He had a very complicated relationship with his family. He was a tough man. He was an athlete. He was loved harness racing. And the one lavish thing he did with his money was buy expensive trotters, which he drove personally against all comers. Into his 80s, he was one of the best drivers on the road. And all of these wealthy men would drive their prized trotters, and they would have pickup races, and Vanderbilt would beat almost all of them. And he built this famous Saratoga Springs harness racing track. He was one of the investors in that. So, you know, he was competitive. He was an athlete. He was a man who was true to his word, as tough as he was, and he drove people crazy. I found one letter that said, "That Vanderbilt is a great blank. You must fill in the blank." But he also said, "We don't have to make a written agreement. You know him as good as my word." And he was honest and true to his word. And as a corporate executive, he took no compensation. The only manipulation he usually did with the stock was to drive it up. Lakeshore investors might not feel that way, but usually. And he only took, the only compensation he got out of his railroads was dividends on the stock he owned. So he's an honest, capable manager of other people's money as well as his own. And yet his sons disappointed him. His older son had a nervous breakdown working on Wall Street, and it was only later that he began to show himself as a very capable businessman, and Vanderbilt made him his great heir. His second son was one of the ways I got access to Vanderbilt's complexity as a person and his private life. His second son was Kernel, or Cornelius Jeremiah. Kernel was everything Vanderbilt wasn't. He was dishonest. He was a gambling addict. He was he suffered from epilepsy, so he wasn't the athlete his father was. He was this. He was verbose. He was boastful. He was self-loathing, and he wrote letter after letter, often to famous men to get money out of them. When Horace Greeley died, he died, you know, with Kernel owing him $30,000. Which he'd spent on gambling money. And so Vanderbilt was frustrated by this son. But what we see is not just a hard and tough man, which is the historical stereotype, you know, almost brutal with his family. Well, he could be really tough in his family. But we also see in his relationship with his wives and with his son, Kernel, he was also had compassion. He also loved him. He also encouraged him to reform himself. He, you know, he had a softer and more complex side. And he was very conflicted about this son who caused him so much trouble. He went back and forth. So again, as a historian and as a writer about a human being, my point is not to be a, you know, to preach what I think or to paint things overly black and white. I want to embrace the complexity and contradictions that are in the person and are in history, and to present the full complexity and these unresolved contradictions as, of who he was as a person and of his role in history, because, you know, people are still arguing about the sort of thing that he represents. And I want to do full justice to both aspects, personally and professionally. When he died, he left $100 million. How much is that in today's dollars? I don't think you can honestly just multiply it by an inflation converter, because the economy was so different. It's not just a balloon that inflates over time. But one measure that gives you a rough idea is the relationship between that value and the amount of money in circulation. And again, this is a rough measure. If Bill Gates, who's the richest man in the world before the crash of 08, if he could have sold his full estate at full market value to American buyers for cash, using the Fed's M2 figure for you wonks in the audience, he would have taken one out of every $138. That's a lot of money for one person. If Vanderbilt could have sold his entire $100 million estate at the moment of his death at full market value to American buyers for cash, using the Treasury's count of cash and demand deposits, he would have taken one out of every $20. And he left 95% of this to one son. His daughters were all left with a very large amount of money for the time, but somehow it didn't seem fair to them, and it led to a great trial over to the will, which is one of the ways people have defined Vanderbilt, often drawing on, you know, salacious and unreliable testimony or even non-testimony claims about him, because one lawyer was trying to prove that Vanderbilt, you know, wasn't in his right mind and couldn't make his own will. And so that sort of distorted our image. But the will was, in fact, ratified by the judge. And the great Vanderbilt dynasty, which runs down to Gloria Cooper, or Gloria Vanderbilt and her son Anderson Cooper, this all comes down, all the Vanderbilts we know of come down from that one son of his surviving children. And for they waited till after their father died, and then they began to spend lavishly. And they began to set themselves up as the new aristocracy of the Gilded Age. As I say, you know, spending with a lavishness that Vanderbilt would have scorned, and yet due to a polarization of wealth that he had pioneered by creating one of the first truly giant fortunes in American history. And at that point, I would like to thank you and open the floor to questions. And don't be afraid to stand up and ask a question. This is an interesting question. She just asked, why did this uneducated man, who actually is not known for charity like Andrew Carnegie is or Rockefeller or others, why did he endow a university? And why did he endow one in the South, in Nashville? Well, there's a couple answers to that question. One is that there's reason to believe that Vanderbilt, even though he didn't like to write, that he was sort of self-conscious about his lack of education. And I don't want to carry that too far. I know one historian who's working on the Vanderbilt family who really believes that, because Vanderbilt was full of self-confidence. But every time there were many occasions, the 19th century, you couldn't sit down for tea without someone getting up and giving a two-hour speech. You probably feel the same way right now, I apologize. And Vanderbilt would get up and he'd say, I don't give speeches, so-and-so is going to make some remarks in my place. He avoided public speaking, sort of exposing himself. Interestingly, those early letters were really written phonetically. You can really capture his speech patterns from his early letters because, you know, a lot of people who couldn't spell wrote in a formal way, but Vanderbilt wrote just as he spoke. His later letters, though, you know, for example, in the 1850s, Cyrus Field was invited him to dinner. Cyrus Field was from an aristocratic family and was the builder of the transatlantic telegraph line cable. And Vanderbilt wrote, you know, I regret that I will be unable to attend in consequence of an engagement previously made. By this stage of his life, he was attaining a higher social status. And yet every word in that handwritten note was wildly misspelled. So this is Vanderbilt. In terms of that personal affect, he was he acquired dignity. He was a street fighter. He got involved in fist fights into his 40s and won. You know, he was a tough guy who came up from the docks, and yet he acquired this great dignity as his wealth he showered him with it. But, you know, he kind of regretted his lack of education. But the most important thing is that having given $1 million steamship to the Union Navy during the war, which he named after one of his heroes. It was the Cornelius Vanderbilt. For a man who generally kept his mouth shut and hated braggarts, he had some pride in himself. He did a lot to help gratis, to help the Union war effort. You know, this is the one sentiment he had. He was not at all religious. But one of his few sentiments was that he was deeply patriotic. And after the Civil War, he believed part of that patriotism was to help the South. And so, for example, his second wife was from Mobile, Alabama. They had, in 1869, as a witness at their wedding, the Confederate General Braxton Bragg. That he, as I mentioned, he stood as a bondsman to bail Jefferson Davis out of prison. And then he deliberately, you know, he had a family connection. His second wife's cousin was the wife of Bishop McTeary, I always mispronounce his name, who was the organizing figure of Vanderbilt University. And so he had this personal connection with him. And Vanderbilt really wanted to take the measure of people, and he liked this bishop. And you know, he liked the idea of giving something to the South. And so when he found out about this, the bishop was smart enough not to ask for money, because that would have cut off. Vanderbilt would have sent him packing. But he waited for Vanderbilt to come up with the offer himself. Vanderbilt deliberately endowed a university in the South as a gesture to help heal the nation after the Civil War. Now, it's important to note that sentiment did not extend to the freed people, to the emancipated slaves. I found no trace of any gestures toward the freed slaves who were struggling so after the Civil War. You know, he was thinking about people at his level. Vanderbilt University, a university for basically wealthy young white men, you know, like he thought of his class as being. And yet the gesture was sincere. The patriotism was very sincere behind it. Yes, sir. He was just reading a line from Hofstadter's one of his great works, that saying that Christian, and of course the United States was during Vanderbilt's lifetime, you know, went through the Second Great Awakening, and you know, there was a lot of evangelical fervor, including among the people he knew, and the quote suggests that the Christian principles are incompatible with aggressive capitalism. And, you know, Vanderbilt, it's interesting, he was a very a-religious man. And one of his acts of charity was to buy a church for his second wife's minister. And he was, at one event, you know, the minister was going on about, you know, some religious principles, talking theology. And Vanderbilt looked at him, and he was very hot, and he was fanning himself. And then he waited him out, and Vanderbilt said, "Reverend, everything you've said has about as much weight with me as that fan." And the only time he ever went to church was for a funeral or a wedding. And so to that extent, you know, Vanderbilt was very much non-religious. And yet, interestingly, you know, this is an age when American business was going from very, very personal to institutionalized, you know, where you had large institutions. And as I said, Vanderbilt, you know, went from being manning the till in a sailboat to being one of the great financial engineers of his day, restructuring corporate debt and reorganizing giant companies and forming giant companies. And yet that sense, that personal reputation is essential, was very important to him. So he had sort of whether Christian principles are incompatible with capitalism is a huge, you know, both philosophical and historical question that people argue about all the time. You know, there's the thesis that, you know, the Protestant work ethic is what made America great. And then, you know, you have quotes like the one you just gave. So I can't answer that question definitively. But let me say that the idea of living by a code and sort of seeing business according to sort of a code of the fair fight was very important to Vanderbilt. And you see that in the fact that, as I mentioned, you know, people would get in angry fights with him, and they would say, "He's cheating us, he's doing this." And Vanderbilt would say, "Fine, let's send our disputes to arbitration." And he always won. That is as tough and as demanding and as infuriating as he could be, he lived by his word. And as I said later on, you know, as the corporations began to rise, Vanderbilt was known as being one of the few really honest corporate managers. And again, you know, this is a point of pride, and it was also good business. People did business with him because even when he was not socially acceptable, they knew they could trust him. And for example, in the 1850s, when he was still, you know, socially not acceptable to the old social elite who still had a lot of money, one of the first credit reports on Vanderbilt, which were really reports about a businessman's character, the ancestor of Dun & Bradstreet did these. The first report about Vanderbilt went on about his, you know, his business career, and then, you know, he's a very effective businessman. Then it said, "He's illiterate and boorish, austere and offensive. When he moved from Staten Island to New York, he was so unpopular, the Staten Islanders had a public jubilee to celebrate his leaving." So, you know, and then at the end of his life, he was having dinner with the Astors, and he was, you know, at the top of society. He sort of was so powerful that, you know, they had to make room for him. And a later credit report about him said that he was high-toned and honorable, that he was a man of his word. You know, what a difference $100 million makes. But part of that, but part of that reflects the fact that, you know, he consistently lived by this code, and then he really did acquire greater social dignity as he got older. But, you know, in the 1850s, when that early quote about him was recorded, Hamilton Fish, the governor of New York, and from one of the great families of New York, there may be a Hamilton Fish who's a congressman now. I mean, this is an old, old family. He contacted Vanderbilt, and I found a letter in the Fish papers where he was asking Vanderbilt to find out about some rumor about people who were trying to stab him in the back. He trusted Vanderbilt to tell him the truth. And he clearly saw Vanderbilt as being of a different social status. So, Christianity, I'm dodging your question. But when it came to having a code of ethics, Vanderbilt very firmly believed in it, and he prospered as a result.
I think Leo LaRocha.
Oh, that's true. Oh, yeah. He said that, the point, the famous quote, nice guys finish last, he said that's often true. And believe me, in Vanderbilt's world, no one was tougher than Vanderbilt. And when he was betrayed, and in a lot of ways this book is a series of ever greater betrayals, and they must have been dumber and dumber because Vanderbilt got revenge on every single one. And sometimes going to literally the ends of the earth, like literally sending down the secret agent with guns to get revenge. And, these guys always ended up coming to him with their hats in hand saying, please, give us a break. And Vanderbilt then, once he'd established, that he was right and that he had crushed them, then he forgave them. And some of his bitterest enemies became his card-playing partners late in life. The only exception was Jay Gould. And when, Jay Gould went out of his way to infuriate Vanderbilt and embarrass him publicly, which really drove him crazy. And so, in one case in 1872, he was very upset because his son-in-law, who he had trusted with the Lakeshore Railway, had started to form an alliance with Jay Gould. And so a reporter asked about this. And so he said, you can take it from me and publish it in your newspaper that Jay Gould is a damned villain. I can't put it strongly enough. And so the reporter writes it down. He's going down the stairs, down the stoop, out into the rain. And Vanderbilt goes to the door and he says, remember, I said he's a damned villain. Write it down. And so that's a very rare exception. Usually, once they had the fight, business is business. It's not personal. With Jay Gould, it was personal. Yes, sir. Well, that's an interesting question. You said creative nonfiction is an interesting term, that it kind of suggests, the A Million Little Pieces style of writing, that you think it's nonfiction, but it's not. What I would say is I think that the term should be something like, except for it sounds maybe too highfalutin, literary nonfiction. That it's a matter of making a work of research and in some cases analysis and scholarship. I believe in those qualities and really being honest and working with primary sources and asking fresh questions. And I subject my manuscripts to review by academic experts. And I'm not required to by my publisher. I do it. And because I want it to stand up and I want it to add to our knowledge of the world. But literary qualities are important to me. It's one reason why I'm not an academic historian. And so that's a matter of shaping the story so that, for one thing, for example, the reader always has a sense that they're going someplace. That it's not just as someone called history once, one damn thing after another. Or, when I go into the contextual information, like looking at the way people thought about the value of a share of stock and what the source of that was, or the politics of competition, I try to present it in a way and limit myself to what you need to know to get the most out of the story. And then sketching characters, and then thinking about, human beings. I mean, this is what literature does, is it probes the human condition. And, the best literature, is offers wisdom as well. And so that really kind of thinking about the humanity and the complexity and the ambiguity of the characters and trying to bring that out, trying to create a fully realized world for you, the reader, so it really transports you. Those are literary qualities that I do my best to bring into my work. And so that would be my answer to you. For example, going back and forth between Vanderbilt's family life and his business career, which I do back and forth all the time, how do I make that transition? How do I make sure they're part of a whole, cohesive whole, so it's not just like dropping out of one story and falling into another one, but you feel that it's all connected? These are writing issues that are very important, and they can't, as you said, they can't override the getting as close to the truth as you can get, and making yourself answerable to evidence and to criticism from experts and our knowledge of that time. So it's always a balancing act. Yes, sir. He asked about the relationship between Vanderbilt and the city of New York. One thing is that no one person invents the modern world. We have books. There was even a book, I think, called The Man Who Invented Air. That's a little bit over the top. So Vanderbilt didn't invent New York or invent capitalism, but he was a key player who left his mark. That's what I would say. And he very much left his mark on the city of New York. Actually, he did through the whole country. I mean, you know, the rise of you know, the trans-Appalachian West, the rise of California and San Francisco during the Gold Rush, the geographical changes in America Vanderbilt was a part of. And the city of New York is always one anchor point in the city where he lived and the city where the financial capital of America always was. He left his mark very much there geographically. So, for example, he built the original Grand Central Station. And there was no railroad station there when he built it. And the modern version, which was erected after they tore down his because it was too small, and they had to make changes, they took a statue from another depot of his, of Vanderbilt, and it's in front of, you know, if you're familiar with New York, from street level you can't see it, but there's a Park Avenue bypass that goes up and around on an upper level around Grand Central, and he's kind of in between, forcing the cars to go away. And he's looking south toward Wall Street. You know, Grand Central was a huge piece of infrastructure that changed the geography of Manhattan. Park Avenue is this beautiful elite avenue. It used to be a gritty street called Fourth Avenue because the railroads ran along the street level, spewing up cinders and smoke. Vanderbilt sank the tracks, and they built a tunnel over the top, which allowed it to become Park Avenue. There are other pieces of railroad infrastructure which are still vital to the city of New York today, where Vanderbilt left his mark. And then, of course, you know, his role in the rise of Wall Street, et cetera, and the whole corporate world we live in today, he left his mark as well. So, you know, there was a, you know, I found my book actually popping up in a bunch of mentions in the New York Times, and they were talking about different aspects of the city because a lot of them, you know, came up because of Vanderbilt, literally building, you know, the original infrastructure of the city. Yes? Oh, that's an interesting question, which I have no answer for. No. he asked if Vanderbilt had made any errors and if he learned from those errors. And, you know, this, again, part of the problem is that some of the errors he made were idiosyncratic, trusting somebody. And as he put it famously, I want to give you the exact quote, after a lifetime in business, again, when he was speaking to the New York state legislature, he made a remark, which actually then he didn't pay enough attention to later because he got burned by it again later. He said, I am not afraid of my enemies, but my God, you must look out when you get among your friends. And, you know, again and again, he trusted people and would be betrayed by them. And so he always believed that you can trust people about as far as your interests, as their interests extend. And so, for example, Daniel Drew was one of the few people to actually drive Vanderbilt to the wall in an early steamboat competition. And Daniel Drew was a guy who was an old cattle drover who then became a master of the New York's livestock market. And through this process became a figure of kind of street-level finance, lending money to, you know, cattle dealers and whatnot. And he got involved in the early steamboat business. Well, Vanderbilt actually often got out of business by taking payoffs. He would leave a market. The Great Competitor was also one of the people who came up with means of controlling competition. They would have agreements. Here's a, you know, $5,000, go somewhere else. And Vanderbilt had to do it to Daniel Drew. And so he didn't want to compete against Daniel Drew ever again. So what they did is they set up a this lifelong process, which fell apart after about 30 years, where they invested in each other's businesses. So each one had a stake in the other guy's businesses. So they had a reason not to compete. So they were good friends, but they made sure that the money was there to speak louder than friendship. And yet, Daniel Drew, in the end, turned against him. In 1867, when Vanderbilt was buying control of the New York Central Railroad after that famous blockade, he was worried that Daniel Drew, who was a famous short seller, Daniel Drew by this time was an official of the Erie Railway, one of the giant railroads in America, and he would routinely go out and short sell Erie stock and then do something to damage Erie's standing on Wall Street. And so he would make a profit by buying back the stock at lower prices. So Daniel Drew was constantly, and when he would do this, you know, driving, he didn't just drive down Erie stock, the whole stock exchange prices would fall. And Vanderbilt was trying to buy control of the New York Central, and he needed prices to be rising because he and his allies were buying on margin, and he wanted stockholders to feel that Vanderbilt's rise was coming into the world was good for everybody. He needed a rising stock market. And he was worried about Drew, and Drew agreed that he would stay out of the market, and Drew reneged. And why did he renege? Because their strategic interests are beginning to diverge. They're beginning to become competitive again. And I won't go into details, but you know, again, the money stopped talking. And once the money was not there to keep them allied, then friendship wasn't enough. And so Drew, and this is only one of the most famous betrayals in the book, Drew said, fine, you know, I will help lead a buying campaign. And he actually managed the money of some of Vanderbilt's allies. And then meanwhile, secretly, he was out short-selling the stock that they were supposedly bullying up on Wall Street. And when Vanderbilt found out, he decided to get revenge on him. And so he carried out, he tried to corner the market in Erie stock, which Vanderbilt, or which Drew was always short-selling. And this led to the famous Erie War of 1868, in which Daniel Drew allied himself with some young men, including Jay Gould, and they began to flout the law, which regulated how many shares of stock a company could issue, and they began to just like come up with flimsy excuses for printing out share after share. And Vanderbilt found that he was buying all of this stock, which was legally dubious at best, which was just hot off the presses, and it led to a fight that ended that led to Vanderbilt having a judge issue arrest warrants for the entire Erie board. So the officials of one of the largest corporations in America, literally with bales of cash and stock, ran down to the docks and took the ferry to New Jersey, and where they post armed guards around their headquarters. And then Jay Gould went to Albany with a suitcase full of cash to bribe the New York State Legislature to legalize, and so, you know, legalize their stock issue. A guy came from, a court official came from, a policeman came from New York to arrest him. And, you know, Jay Gould seems to have convinced him that being arrested meant just hanging around while Jay Gould did his business was fine. The suitcase got a little bit lighter, you know, after that transaction. And so, you know, Vanderbilt was burned by this. He was able to keep the arrest warrants out so that the Erie guys were forced to make a deal with Vanderbilt and pay him back his losses. But his corner was defeated. And Vanderbilt's attempt at revenge was defeated. And that, you know, it all happened because, again, a rare case where he trusted his verbal agreement with Daniel Drew and with some other fellows. And, you know, again and again with Jay Gould, he would come up against Jay Gould, not again and again, but in a couple of cases, he would have these public fights with Jay Gould. And Jay Gould didn't really defeat him, but he would find ways to embarrass him, and then Vanderbilt would have to pull back. One case was in 1870, Jay Gould became the president of the Erie Railway. And Jay Gould started a rate war for livestock from Chicago to New York. So that it was $150 for a cattle car. And Jay Gould started cutting the price in New York Central, Vanderbilt's line now, followed suit. And they went from $150 down to $1 a car. Well, meanwhile, Jay Gould and his ally Jim Fisk went to Chicago secretly and began to buy thousands of heads of cattle, which they shipped over the New York Central for almost nothing. So they made a nice little profit, you know, at Vanderbilt's expense. Not satisfied with that, they went to the press, and they had the equivalent of a press conference and said, guess what we did to Vanderbilt? And so, you know, then immediately the New York Central raises its livestock rates. That kind of thing, it was a trivial, it wasn't really a defeat, it was just an embarrassment. And yet, that sort of thing, Vanderbilt finally learned his lesson. There's a saying that he supposedly said about Jay Gould, which I couldn't find any source for, good source, so I didn't put it in the book. I'll just tell you guys. It never pays to kick a skunk. And that's the way he felt. That's the way he definitely felt about Jay Gould. And so, you know, he finally said, okay, whatever he does, I'm just not going wherever Jay Gould is. And he left him alone in the end. Again, you know, Jay Gould never really defeated him, but he managed to embarrass him more than once. So again, but it comes back to this whole question of, you know, nice guys finish last. You don't trust people to be friends with you and then to be true to their word because you're friends. You make sure their money mandates that they stand by their word. And that was the lesson that Vanderbilt, unfortunately, had driven home more than once in his lifetime. Thank you very much.
Excellent.